This is the Voice of Freedom.
Do you really understand what this country is all about?
This is our manifesto. This is our rallying cry. This is our reply.
There is absolutely no evidence to support the statement that we're the greatest country in the world.
Today it's time to stop singing and start swinging.
You've got to say, I'm a human being. God damn it. My life has value.
You want to claim this land is a land of the free? Then the symbol of your country cannot just be a flag.
Yep. I've said it before and I'll say it again. Life moves pretty fast. You don't stop and look around every once in a while. You can miss it.
All right, now you sons of bitches. You know how I feel.
What's up, Hep Cadets, Cats, and Kittens? It's your host, Moxie O'Brien, back again with another episode of Come and See here on another Friday morning in America. And I'm excited about today's episode for a lot of reasons, but before I get into that, I'm going to do the business stuff up top. Here we go. So I want to give a shout out, first and foremost, to the newest member of the Hep cult, Brennan. Thank you very much. Welcome aboard. We appreciate you. And I want to let everyone listening know that if you'd like to become a member of the illustrious and ever-growing Hep cult, you can do so by going to www.patreon.com/comeandseepod. And there's a few options available for you there that if you, you'd like to help me pay some bills, keep the lights on, feed myself, or you just think I'm cute, you can throw some money my way there. And also, the merch store for the upcoming Come and See Coffee, Behold a Dark Roast, is in the process of being built here. That'll be live by the end of the week. And I think I've sorted out my t-shirt issues, so I should have t-shirts available before the beginning of the next season of the show as well. So the Come and See merch store is coming to you as well, and I'm very excited about that because it's taken me like a year and a half to get that figured out, but here we go. I think that's the business stuff out of the way, right? Yeah, okay, so today's episode of the show is one that I've actually been planning on doing since before I even started this show. I originally conceived of this back in 2020 when I was still working on the Four Cornered Room because it felt, based on what I saw happening in protest and activist culture back in 2020, like something that needed to be addressed. And since then, there's been events that have taken place that have reinforced that belief for me. Like, for example, January 6th, I saw a lot of people on the left expressing that a right-wing overthrow of the United States government would be a good thing, which is objectively fucking stupid, and you should stop thinking that. And I think that historically, there is evidence that the left helping to foster a right-wing insurrection, a right-wing coup, etc., yields severely negative results for the left. And there's a very poignant example of that in Nazi Germany. So today, we're going to talk about the Night of the Long Knives. Now, the Night of the Long Knives is sort of, it's an individualized event, and I kind of hate people who cover World War II and the Nazi Party and Adolf Hitler and that whole time period in world history, because they usually do it in an isolated way that suggests, oh, nothing happened and then this happened, as some sort of a strange aberration with absolutely nothing that contributed to the event whatsoever. And then we fixed it and we moved on. But in actuality, as long-time listeners, I hate that expression, of this show are aware, a lot of events in the preceding 100 years led up to the creation of the Nazis. A lot of things happening internationally contributed to the creation of the Nazis and the kickoff of World War II. And to sort of paint the Nazis as a weird fascist aberration is entirely inaccurate, because I think it's really more appropriate to say that authoritarianism was like a 20th century phenomenon, and really I think we probably should leave it there. But that there were, in reaction to inherent flaws in capitalism, authoritarian, totalitarian, dictator, etc. forms of government were popping up all over the planet. The Nazis were just kind of like the one that we all took note of because they killed a whole lot of people. But, I mean, even that's not necessarily, like, unique amongst a lot of authoritarian or totalitarian dictatorships in the 20th century. There's a lot of examples of that. I think that as an American, the Nazis are sort of prevalent in our historical narrative because this country has been obsessed with the Nazis for a very long time. I think because the Nazis were sort of like the natural progression of what we'd been doing here for quite some time, with Jim Crow and racial science and what we'd been doing to Native Americans and a lot of other things. So I think that the obsession with the Nazis in the United States is because the Nazis were kind of cosplaying a version of what we wanted to be doing here. And after seeing that in action, a lot of Americans have been kind of obsessed with that idea ever since. I mean, the first neo-Nazis appeared less than 10 years after the end of the war. So it's something that has always kind of fascinated this country. And as such, like, I don't like the way it gets covered often. But I do think a conversation about how the Nazi Party courted the left wing in an attempt to grow its base up until the point at which Hitler was kind of unimpeachable to everybody but one guy, and then the left was no longer useful to the Nazi Party, and all of the high-ranking left-leaning officials within the Nazi Party were murdered. Now, it's also worth mentioning up top that while we're talking about quote-unquote left-leaning Nazis, these were still Nazis. I mean, the working class-centric sect of the Nazi Party still focused on anti-Semitism as a tent pole of its belief system. These weren't like the good guys within the bad team or something like that. Don't conceptualize it in that way in your mind. That isn't what happened. This was a right-wing fascist group that assimilated a left-wing segment to appeal to people due to an understanding that ultra-conservatism doesn't really appeal to most people. And in that, you can see echoes of how this strategy has been used or has attempted to be used in this country by various right-wing groups, whether we're talking about the Boogaloos or, MAGA really is another fine example of this, in that fascism with a populist mask on is very, very effective for mobilizing large numbers of people. And I think that we should be aware of that whenever we see right-wing organizations talking about saving the children, or the advent of, you know, patriotic socialism, which is really just national Bolshevism, which is something we're going to talk about today, actually. So I think that there's a lot to be mined from this particular subject, and for that reason, I've been wanting to cover it on a show since before I even had this show. So today, I'm going to do that. And I also think that when we're talking about the development of a fascist dictatorship in Nazi Germany, it's important to note that it didn't happen overnight, and the first couple of attempts didn't work. There was a over decade-long refination process of massaging the Nazi ideology and forming the Nazi Party in such a way that politicians, the aristocracy, and the working class all thought this was a group for them. But ultimately, it ended up being a group for one guy. And I think that is of paramount interest at a time period whenever we're looking at some of the people running for office in this country and saying to ourselves, huh, I wonder what your reading material has consisted of. So today we're going to talk about the Night of the Long Knives and why leftists should not form coalition governments with the right wing. And one last bit of business before we get into today's episode. I'm going to wrap season 3 this week. There's a few things related to this particular subject, the Nazis, that I've been meaning to cover, and I'm going to hit those this week before sliding out of here and taking January off to get some clerical things done, build the next set of episodes up, and we'll be back in February for season 4. So there's, including this one, 3 episodes of this season left, and then we'll be back next year. So that's just giving you a heads up. Get ready to miss me for a couple of weeks. But I think that's everything I have, so let's go ahead and get into the material. Here we go. I think an essential piece in understanding the Night of the Long Knives and really the Nazi Party's consolidation of power in Germany is the Treaty of Versailles. And we'll probably cover the Treaty of Versailles itself in greater detail at some point, but today we're going to start off with German disarmament and the regulations on the German military. Allied leadership dictated at the Paris Peace Conference that the German military would cease production on things like armored vehicles and poison gas, which limited the German manufacturing base, and also the size of the German military was restricted to 1,000 soldiers. The Germans were forbidden from importing or exporting war materials, and if that seems vague, it was supposed to be. Tanks, submarines, heavy artillery production was banned outright, and Germany was given 2 months to surrender all war materials, which was a list expanded to include grenades, detonators, flamethrowers, rifles, fuses, optical instruments, field ambulances, gas masks, telephones, uniforms. There was a massive list that was compiled and published outlining banned materials called the Blue Book. The final version of the Blue Book included things like buses and cooking utensils. And in reaction to this, German objections to this ridiculous list of things, the Allies sold some of these items from the banned list back to Germany as a credit towards the post-war reparations, which Germany was also responsible for paying. From the very beginning, critics of the treaty's oppressive restrictions would serve to foment resentment from the Germans, which, of course, it did. France took particular interest in German disarmament, in part due to their shared borders, and the French referred to the treaty as a, quote, moral disarmament for the safety of the French borders and French sovereignty. Generally speaking, though, the Allied forces sought to contain and neutralize Germany economically in a race toward Western imperial dominance between America, France, and England, basically to see who would be competing with Russia, where revolution had ended the line of the Tsars and seen the emergence of Bolshevism, and in the early 20s, the ascension of Stalin. A disenfranchisement with Germany's aristocracy had also seen the development of the Spartacus League, which was a Marxist-Leninist revolutionary movement formed in Germany before the end of the First World War. The Spartacists, as they were called, opposed Germany's participation in the war and wished to abolish the German monarchy and establish a sister Soviet republic in Germany. And what you see, socially speaking, well, no, I'll get to that later. In January of 1919, the Spartacus League led the Spartacist Uprising, which was a general strike and an ensuing, it's probably not fair to call it armed conflict, more of a massacre, between Germany's Social Democratic Party and the developing Communist Party of Germany. In the past, in the post-war power vacuum that was created by a disarmed military, the revolutionary stewards, who were like leftist shopkeepers, basically, the Spartacists and the German communists clashed with Friedrich Ebert's coalition between Germany's social democrats, the business class, and the military, who were really looking to reestablish a German republic. All of this is to illustrate a point. Post-war Germany was wildly sectarian in the wake of imperial collapse, and at first, conflicts existed between several left and left-leaning sects. And, of course, business and the military stood unified in opposition, wishing the more beneficial for institution system, the traditional way of doing things, would prevail, and throwing money at various groups to help facilitate the legwork in the furtherance of their goals. The Spartacist uprising had been triggered when Ebert had dismissed a police chief who had the previous day refused to give an order for police to open fire on a crowd of communist protesters. Armed demonstrators occupied the printing plants of the SDP's newspapers and their publishing houses, effectively taking over the German newspaper district. They were joined in solidarity by some 500,000 members of the German working class, who supported the action but did not directly participate. They did stand in between the German police and those occupying the buildings, though, so they had human shields. Over the following 2 days, morale fell as the next action, whether to institute a general strike and call for the resignation of the sitting German government, or just to go directly to civil war, couldn't be agreed upon. See, they had basically decided to take over this government building without having a plan, and 500,000 people showed up and said, oh, this is it, the people are revolting, let's do this, and then realized the people in charge didn't really have a plan beyond taking over the building, and they spent the next 48 hours arguing over what to do next. So while this argument is taking place over the next course of action, they were also attempting solidarity with the German military because they were hoping to get military backing in this uprising, and therefore they would have the support of the German working class and the German military, and then they would be able to overthrow the German government and institute a similar Bolshevik revolution in Germany. That was the ultimate plan for some of them. Others were more interested in forming a dictatorship of the proletariat, specifically just getting a whole bunch of workers together and overthrowing the government that way. And there was a real argument that took place over which course of action made the most sense at this critical point. I know that seems like something you probably should have talked about before you left the house, but what are you going to do? And while this argument is taking place, Ebert mobilized several units of the Freikorps. The Freikorps was basically a volunteer paramilitary fight club made up of war veterans. Think of them as not like a one-to-one for, but kind of adjacent to America's Boogaloo Boys. not specifically government affiliated, but like useful goons in lieu of an actual military, many of whom had served in the military. Freikorps is German for free regiment, hence the volunteer part. Like I mentioned, the Treaty of Versailles limited the number of paid German troops who were allowed to be conscripted into military service, so volunteer soldiers were a common workaround. When Ebert mobilized the Freikorps units to converge on the newspaper district, there was suddenly an armed militia working on behalf of, but not specifically representing, the government of Germany. Starting to sound familiar yet? The Spartacists led a general strike and threatened to mobilize the labor class to overthrow the Social Democrats if the police chief who had been dismissed were not reinstated. Members of the German Communist Party acted as human shields, blocking access to the buildings of the district and forcing Ebert into negotiations. After negotiations broke down, the Spartacists were threatened with being wiped out, and warrants for all of their arrests were issued. The people remained on strike, calling for a full resignation of Ebert and the acting Social Democratic government, and for a unification of the Social Democrats and the developing Communist Party of Germany, forming some sort of a coalition government. On January 10th, the Freikorps attacked the Spartacist headquarters, and the following morning, the order was given to attack the newspaper district. Completely unprepared for violence, the Spartacist insurgents were quickly overwhelmed by flamethrowers, machine guns, mortars, and heavy artillery. Things you can use when you're not technically a part of the military, but working on behalf of the military. You know, kind of like Blackwater. Anyway, there were no organized battles that took place during this massacre, and between 130 and 180 Spartacists and German civilians were killed over the next 24 hours. The founders and architects of the uprising, Rosa Luxemburg and Karl Liebknecht, were arrested and killed on January 15th. Which led to a massive period of German civil unrest that resulted in 5,000 deaths over the next several months. On January 19th, elections were held for the National Assembly and the Weimar Republic and Weimar Constitution were established, because splits between the various left-wing sects resulted in a 38% vote in favor of the National Assembly, constituting a majority of the vote. And in the fallout of this, fighting in the street between the German communists and the German Social Democrats was common, and neither group ever attempted a mass organization of the worker class after the Spartacists did, but the strength in German labor and its ability to hold the government hostage really didn't go unnoticed. And this is what I was going to say earlier, that in this, you see an echo of what happened in the United States, that the ability to use labor as sort of a vehicle for leftist ideology to the general public has been successful. A lack of a plan for what to do after you do that, and a misunderstanding of the kind of people you're dealing with in the business class, the military, and the far right wing, usually results in the crushing of the left wing sect of that and a sect of that labor movement, and the co-opting or destruction of that labor movement, and a bolstering of belief amongst the people in the effectiveness of fascism, the business class, and the military, because they have been able to, in full view of the public, destroy left wing movements. So you end up with a general public that sees communism, socialism, left-wing ideology as weak and incapable of making things happen in the face of the military-industrial complex, who is ruthless and productive in the kind of systems that they are operating in. Systems that are usually set up by people who share common interests with them. Because as we've discussed in previous episodes, like the episode on Christofascism, business and fascism make easy bedfellows. Fascists still have to buy things. So that marriage is easy. Whereas on the left, we have various deal-breaking differences in our sectarian beliefs in the implementation of a leftist revolution slash government that prevent us from coalescing in any meaningful way. So you have various dozens, if not hundreds, of smaller groups that don't communicate and can't get along in the face of an extraordinarily well-funded and unified front on the other end of things. And that always ends the same way. The only times that it doesn't is whenever the government already doesn't have a firm footing or good funding, or you have a group of insurgents capable of infiltrating that who are well-funded by somebody. Germany had neither. So the left wing as a legitimate movement within the country sort of failed, but it didn't go away. It remained popular within the labor movement. And communism remained a presence until the 30s, of course. And there was a constant tug of war between these various leftist sects that sort of allowed the growing fascist movement in the German Workers' Party that would eventually become the Nazi Party to say, look at how disorganized and unproductive they are. We're getting things done, and we represent the German people. In the case of the communists, the German Worker Party could say, these people represent Russia. They don't the Soviet Union. Anachronism, sorry. These people don't represent Germany. In the case of the Social Democrats, they could say, look at how easily they're overtaken by the communists. If you put the Social Democrats in charge, the communists will overthrow them and the country will fall to the Soviets. You need us to keep them out of power. And that works because the exact same fucking thing happened here. And that is the first of many, I think, observable parallels in the story we're covering today. Let me go on. Now, while the Spartacist uprising did sort of engender some enmity for the Communist Party and the general public, in that it was viewed and touted by the press as an event where the German Bolshevists got a bunch of German civilians murdered, and also the ensuing street violence didn't serve as a real way to recruit new people outside of the labor movement, the labor movement was still powerful within German society, and German labor's left and often socialist orientation presented problems for any right-wing political movement looking to consolidate power. Expansion within the Weimars was easy. Not without its own need for assassinations and consolidations, of course, but it's easier for fascism to move within the political structure, particularly a democratic political structure where palm greasing gets you a long way. Hitler's two greatest roadblocks on his rise to Führer were the German military and the left-leaning German labor class. While, as I said, anti-Bolshevism grew in popularity after the Spartacist uprising, groups such as the League for the Protection of German Culture began organizing to fight the German Communist Party in the street. The majority of Germany's labor class remained left-leaning and socialist, however. It's to this end that National Socialism was conceived, a way to create a fascist movement within a left-leaning labor movement. The pre-World War II Nazi Party's left wing, and it did have one, were typically followers of something called Strasserism, which was a radical worker-based form of National Socialism that featured something called economic anti-Semitism as a means toward German national rebirth. The originators of the ideology were Otto and Gregor Strasser, both members of the Nazi Party initially, until Otto was expelled in 1930 due to his opposition of Hitler. Gregor, on the other hand, was an ultra-nationalist and a member of the Freikorps. He'd had his own street fighting league, the Werverband, which merged with the Nazi Party in 1921, and Gregor actually participated in the Beer Hall Putsch in 1923. Strasser was a supporter of Hitler, but he believed that a Nazi regime should eliminate poverty and unemployment for Germans, of course, not for everybody else. Strasserism called for an end to capitalism, implying that capitalism is inherently flawed because of a Jewish origin intended to pave the way for communism. The Strassers applied this populist anti-Jewish ideology to writings on class conflict, wealth redistribution, and a possible Nazi alliance with Stalin and the Soviet Union to structure the national revolution around worker solidarity. Otto wrote the National Socialist Brief in 1925 and Cabinet Seat or Revolution in 1930. The latter accused Hitler's National Socialism of abandoning socialism and having no focus on the German worker. While Gregor agreed, Otto was the more influential of the two within the party, and so he was expelled. Gregor remained, voicing dissatisfaction with Hitler and a desire to refocus the Nazi Party on the working class. Otto would expound on Strasserist theory in regards to critiques of state and capitalism, while within the party, Gregor advocated for class abolition and the end of the German aristocracy and a unification with the Soviets. This worker-centric anti-bourgeois strain in Nazism was very attractive to German workers who joined the party in many cases not so much out of admiration for Hitler, but enticement by the idea of a revolution of the working class that would elevate the German worker and eliminate the elites in the Republic. When Hitler was banned from public speaking following the Beer Hall Putsch, he deputized Gregor Strasser as the speaker and representative to the public of the Nazi Party. And Strasser's version of Nazism helped establish the party as a German-wide presence. See, previous to this, the Nazi Party and Adolf Hitler both were viewed by much of the general public as a fanatical sect of far right wing group based only really in southern Germany that hadn't spread to the rest of the country. Strasser's message of worker revolution and his time as the public speaker of the party is what transformed Nazism into something that appealed to more than just the ultra-right-wing racist sect of the country. And I mean, don't get me wrong, the Strassers were still racist because racism plays, just like here. Sure, you had people like David Duke and people like George Lincoln Rockwell and people like Robert Welch in the 50s, 60s, and 70s who kind of broke the door down by just being incredibly racist and out front with their white supremacist beliefs. And that paved the road for people like Donald Trump to use that template to appeal to a massive base of people saying essentially the same thing in such a way that you could still say it on television without having to edit anything out. And that is how you, as I believe Ye West referred to himself, serve as a battering ram for Nazism and white supremacy. While Hitler was banned from speaking publicly and being a more fanatical and violent face of the movement, Strasser was calling for nationalization and government run by the people and a worker revolution that would precipitate a national revolution in concert with the Soviets. Strasser built political alliances for the party in the east and north, in the east and in northern Germany, and the socialist wing of the National Socialists grew significantly in popularity. Otto published Combat Publishing and the Berlin Workers newspaper, continuing to espouse a Nazism of the working class. The opposing sects of Strasser's left-leaning pro-Stalinist Nazism and Hitler's vision of autocracy ultimately came to a head for control of the party in 1925 at the Bamberg Conference, with Hitler winning out as the figurehead of Nazism. Bamberg was also relevant because it established leadership for the SA in Ernst Röhm, who we'll get to in a minute. First, the SA. The Sturmabteilung, Storm Detachment, or the Brown Shirts, if you'd rather. This was Hitler's answer to German disarmament, at least at first. The paramilitary arm of the Nazi Party, the Brown Shirts, were founded in 1921 as a means of both disruption and protection for Nazi political ends. They fought the Communist Party and the Social Democrats, and they intimidated the various groups that were targeted by the Nazis, like Roma and the Jews. The Brown Shirts, in a way, predate the Nazi Party itself, beginning with the specialized assault troops of Imperial Germany in the First World War, going on to form those Freikorps regiments that I discussed earlier in 1952, associating with the pre-Nazi German Workers Party before Hitler joined it in September of 1919. When the National Socialist Party was christened the following year, volunteer squads of fighting men accompanied the rallies and clashed with communists and social democrats, and many of these were the Freikorps veterans and friends of Hitler from the war. And all attempts to protest Hitler's speaking engagements were met with violence from this paramilitary group of veteran Nazis who became the Brown Shirts. While useful in combating the wide open German political field by creating disruption at social democratic and communist rallies, and also providing armed protection for Nazi Party events and leaders, the Brown Shirts were basically just a bunch of grizzled drunk goons. The name Sturmabteilung, started being used in 1921 after a particularly violent battle at the Munich Hofbrauhaus between the Brown Shirts and the German communists. In a time when the Versailles Treaty forbade military recruitment, many men forced out of the military gravitated toward the guy who was going around promising to regrow the German military, hence the Brown Shirts. The SA had been outlawed following the Beer Hall Putsch, and an alternative, the Frontbahn, was organized by Ernst Röhm, who was then tasked with rebuilding the SA by Hitler upon his release from prison. It wasn't anything serious. He was only in for like 9 months of a 5-year sentence. Anyway, Röhm had been a member of the German Workers' Party and an early, allegedly founding member of the Brown Shirts. He'd served in the Bavarian infantry in the First World War, and he'd been awarded as a veteran, although considered somewhat fanatical and a bit of an adventurist by many of his peers. Röhm was popular with many German veterans, who joined the Brown Shirts in many cases due to his endorsement. His involvement with the Nazi Party helped resolve some of Hitler's military problem. Most right-wing militant political sects active in Germany at the time respected Röhm, and he helped the Nazi Party develop a militant wing to complement Strasser's labor revolution rhetoric. Röhm consolidated the various right-wing paramilitary groups under the SA banner as one massive militia subordinate to Hitler that eventually outnumbered the German military, who, once again you'll remember, was limited to 100,000 men. The combination of Strasser's populism and Röhm's militant fanaticism transformed the Nazis into a national movement for the people of Germany. The German police and the conscripted military remained skeptical, of course, for the same reasons that the party was growing in popularity in the first place. In reality, Hitler's own goals were more in line with theirs, but revealing that would risk the loss of the party's new mass appeal. Much like Strasser, Röhm had radical ideas for a post-revolutionary regime and the party itself that ran counter to Hitler's vision. And his open sexuality offended the more conservative members of the party. And it didn't help Hitler's standing with the German military brass either. Röhm was a homosexual in a predominantly conservative movement, and his popularity allowed him to be tolerated but never particularly enjoyed, if you catch my drift, Milo. By 1931, Röhm's brown shirts numbered over 1 million, in contrast to the 100,000 men of the German military dictated by the Treaty of Versailles. The brown shirts supported workers in many labor strikes, fighting with both the German police and strikebreakers, generating further support for the Nazis and ultimately for Hitler. While the reputation of the group for drunken violence was well earned, and rumors about Röhm and his deputy Edmund Heinz's sexual relationships kind of marred their reputation with the upper members of Nazi leadership, as well as the broader Weimar government, the brown shirts fairly neutralized the German Communist Party. While Strasser and Röhm were won over the people, Hitler established his own personal elite paramilitary unit outside of the brown shirts, who held no allegiance to anyone but Hitler, the SS. The Schutzstaffel were sort of like fundamentalist Nazis. Eventually, the SA's duty of protecting vital party members was replaced by the SS, who were more like Mussolini's black shirts than Röhm's faux Bolshevik SA. The SS had two divisions, the Allgemeine, or General, and the Waffen, or armed. The Allgemeine enforced Nazi policing once the party assumed power and made up the Gestapo and things like that. The Waffen were combat units and concentration camp staff, and the group was overseen by perhaps the most fanatical of the party, Heinrich Himmler. We'll do an episode about him eventually, I'm sure. This fanatical core, though, kept Hitler insulated from the machinations of other party members during his rise to power and attempts to work himself and ingratiate himself within the German political class. And of course, enmity existed between the brown shirts and the SS. The SA held a more prominent position within the party due to its massive size and Röhm's influence, but the groups coexisted successfully out of a mutual commitment to prevent communism more than anything. Hitler, much like the German military, was concerned that the SA was too large and too loyal to Röhm, and also disliked Strasser, but understood his usefulness to the continuing populist support of the party, and so he opted to abide the leftist sect of the party, despite rumors that Strasser and Joseph Goebbels wished to overthrow him, and that Röhm was plotting a coup. In this way, the SS served to protect Hitler from potential threats within the Nazi party, such as continuing calls from Strasser and Goebbels to form a coalition with Stalin to overthrow the Weimar Republic, which Hitler privately referred to as heresy. Goebbels would later become one of Hitler's most avid supporters, however, embracing Hitler's cult of personality and becoming a harsh and vocal critic of Strasser and Strasserism. Hitler would send Goebbels to Berlin to test and prune the SA of members who sympathized with the Soviet Union. The undeniable influence of the Nazi Party, in part or mostly due to Strasser in Rome, again a communist and a homosexual who held high rank in the Nazi Party for over a decade at that point, resulted in Hitler's appointment to Chancellor in 1933. With this validation of the party, Rome began speaking about a desire to merge the brown shirts and the German military under his command, an idea that further soured the relationship between the military and the Nazis. Now that he was chancellor, the disruptive tactics of the brown shirts' street fighting brigades served to potentially destabilize the government that Hitler was on the verge of becoming in control of. His appointment saw his personal rise legitimized and also a high point in dissatisfaction with Hitler within the party. The National Revolution of the People hadn't actually been about the people, and some of the people were pretty fucking pissed about it. In the months following his appointment to chancellor, Hitler carried out the Gleichschaltung, the coordination, which was a rapid Nazification of an abolition of the Republic, culminating in the prohibition of all other political organizations and the declaration of Germany as a one-party state. And suddenly, there was a million-man disruption squad with nothing to disrupt, and a call for an abolition of the state, and Hitler was the state now. As a means to rectify this, and also to solidify a relationship with the German military and the German police, Hitler and his SS officers conceived of something called Operation Hummingbird, which was a purge of the now unnecessary and untrustworthy elements of the Nazi Party itself, as well as those who had opposed the Beer Hall Putsch and other long-abided political opponents of Adolf Hitler. See, the Chancellor position didn't grant commandment of the German military, and that was the last piece in the puzzle for full political power. The military hated Strasser, viewing his sympathy for Stalin as dangerous, and Rome's homosexuality and aspirations to assimilate the German military into the brown shirts, which was now fucking huge, also made the military and Hitler himself very uncomfortable. Getting rid of both would serve the dual purpose of eliminating aberrant leftist elements from the party and finally securing the support of the military. With no communists to fight, the brown shirts were now just attacking civilians and then getting into fights with the police when they showed up. Hitler didn't need a militia anymore. And many of the leading officers of the SA had become openly critical of the army and their lack of commitment to the cause of National Socialism. By 1934, the brown shirts numbered over 3 million and basically made everybody fucking nervous. Hitler compelled Rome to sign a pledge, recognizing the authority of the military in February of that year, and announced that the SA was an auxiliary to the German military, removing some of the autonomy of the brown shirts and expanding the German military for the first time in defiance of the Treaty of Versailles disarmament provision. Rome signed the agreement, but he criticized Hitler for abandoning revolution in favor of becoming the state, and he began speaking in contradiction of Hitler amongst the brown shirts. Over time, conflict and resentment towards Rome and the SS grew amongst Hitler's most faithful, namely Himmler, the SS, Goebbels, the fanatical convert, Hermann Göring, and Rudolf Hess, and a plot to kill Rome and those most loyal to him, called Hummingbird, continued to take shape. Control of the Gestapo was given to Himmler and the SS, who appointed Reinhard Heydrich to run the secret police, with the first job given to the group was monitoring the brown shirts. Goering and Himmler used information gathered by the Gestapo to compile a liquidation list that was then circulated amongst the SS. In an attempt to influence Hitler to execute the plot, Benito Mussolini was asked to relate to Hitler that the brown shirts gave the party a black eye. He told Hitler that Rome's homosexuality, the group's reputation for drunken violence, and their lack of stability in leadership, and also their open criticism of Adolf Hitler, was something that was making the party look weak to everyone around the world. And while this did have an effect on Hitler, it didn't force him to implement Operation Hummingbird. There was also continued conservative pressure over Strasser's pro-Bolshevism and the idea that Rome had aspirations to take over the military and possibly oust Hitler from the party. Hitler still remained unconvinced of the necessity to kill Rome, possibly out of a fear over the size of the brown shirt militia, and perhaps something else, but growing concerns that the president, Paul von Hindenburg, may declare martial law to neutralize the SA, finally pushed Hitler to execute Operation Hummingbird on June 30th, 1934. There had been a massive street fight with serious damage to public property the night before, and Hitler flew to Munich and arrested Ernst Röhm himself. SA Deputy Edmund Heinz was found in bed with an 18-year-old unidentified male, and both were taken outside behind the hotel and shot immediately. Members of the SA leadership were rounded up and executed, while Hitler returned to Munich and delivered a speech about uncovering treachery and treason amongst SA leadership. Strasser, too, was killed, as well as at least 85 other noted critics of Hitler, like Kurt von Schleicher, Gustav Kahr, and Eric Klausner. Many of these murdered were reported as having Heil Hitler as their last words, unaware that Hitler had been the one who had them executed. Röhm himself was taken to Stadelheim prison in Munich and handed a pistol. He was given 10 minutes to shoot himself, and to which he allegedly responded, quote, "If I am to be killed, let Adolf do it himself." When the 10 minutes passed, Röhm was shot and killed. In the wake of the purge, propaganda, framing it as a crackdown on moral turpitude, was circulated, and to further appease conservatives, Röhm's replacement, Victor Lutze, was tasked with suppressing homosexuality and closing gay clubs and porn shops. The SA, which had been run and popularized by a gay man, became the face of the Nazis' gay purge. Röhm was removed from all propaganda and film from the Nuremberg rally, where he had previously stood right next to Hitler. After the death of Strasser and subsequent abolition of trade unions, the German Labor Front was founded as the official labor union of the Nazi Party. Using his new position as High Chancellor and effective autocrat of Germany, Hitler renegotiated his book deal for Mein Kampf to give himself 15% of all profits, and in the year 1933 to 1934, he made well over $5 million in sales on that book. Able to fund himself and cure himself of ever having to worry about poverty ever again. And in this, all of the issues that stood in the way of Hitler's rise to power and consolidation of both German political power and political power within the Nazi Party itself were solved all at one time. And I think it's important to look at this as a model, an illustration of how a fascist, a totalitarian at that, an autocrat, a dictator, whatever the fuck you want to call Adolf Hitler, used and openly disagreed with, in many cases, the populist ideas of worker solidarity, a revolutionary ideology of overthrowing the government in favor of a proletariat made up of the people. And I mean, like I said, his brown shirts backed up socialists in labor disputes in many cases, because there were people, and I think this is interesting too because of how the discourse around the Nazis often takes place between people on the right and people on the left. There were people back then, and this was intentional, who thought that the National Socialist Workers' Party was a socialist workers' party. And it wasn't. But they allowed people to think it was because the idea of a socialist workers' party appealed to the workers. And you see that manifest in conversations about the Nazis now. Well, here's why socialism is bad. The Nazis were socialist. No, they weren't. At least not after the implementation of Hitler's rise to power and Nazification of the German government and abolition of the Republic. The Nazis allowed people to believe they were a socialist movement of the people until it was no longer convenient. And then everyone who had been allowed to advocate those ideas that the Nazis were not what the Nazis were was executed. And anyone who talked about them was thrown in prison. And any reference to them in historical record was removed. And anything related to them was destroyed. And all of a sudden, this movement that had grown in popularity, and you see all the footage of the people doing the Roman salute and everybody happily yelling Heil Hitler at parades and whatnot, that was brought about by this idea that a revolution of the working man was coming to restore German solidarity and the power of the German people. But it was all about one guy taking over a country who just lied to people and put the right people in the right places to appeal to massive numbers of the population until it no longer mattered if everyone liked him anymore or not. And it wasn't, oh, the message of fascist dictatorship appealed to millions of people. No. He let a guy do his talking for him that he absolutely fucking hated for 10 years just because he knew it was going to bring in the people that he needed to bring in. And as soon as his work behind the scenes consolidating political power within a freewheeling social democracy that allowed him to make backdoor deals with banks and the financial district and people in this country like the Bush family, for example, to bolster the finances of the Nazi party and make a lot of the banks in Germany beholden to the Nazis and therefore give himself the ability to leverage political deals on this end of things. He had a psycho war veteran, you know, like Stu Rhodes, and a pro-Stalinist philosopher speaking about the benefits of worker revolution and the elevation of the German people through economic means over here. And these two groups created the Nazi Party while Hitler worked behind the scenes to make himself important to the people who actually mattered. And once he had become chancellor and he was only beholden to one man and no longer needed fanatical military nuts and left-wing populism, he shed those things. And it was as if they had never been there in the first place. And anytime a Candace Owens or a Milo Yiannopoulos or a Stu Rhodes or a Henry Tarrio or fucking even a Nick Fuentes, listen, look at your last name, dude, starts working for the purposes of furtherance of fascism, be it Christo-fascism or otherwise, in the United States of America, I feel like everyone needs to take a moment And remember what happens when those people get what they need from you and you don't look like the template that they've been telling everyone that they need to meet. It's great that you're gay now. They need the gay vote. They need gay support. They need gay allies. It's great that you're black now. It's great that you're whatever, trans, non-binary, a woman, whatever group that you happen to be that isn't white, Christian, male, heterosexual. They need you now. They won't eventually. And when they no longer do, this is what happens to you. Ditches are full of useful idiots, is the point that I'm making. And in this particular case, the Nazi Party, one of, you know, history's most oft-touted examples of a totalitarian dictatorship, became that way through the use of espousing leftist rhetoric and appealing to military adventurism at a time when they were being economically sanctioned by the three largest economies in the world, so that those three governments could fight it out to see who was going to get to take on Big Daddy Communism over here in the Soviet Union. And it's remarkable how fucking stupid 20th century geopolitics ultimately are. But because we have this biological determination to do it again, I feel like we should talk about all of the glaring examples for why it was a bad idea, why it didn't work the first time, and how the same thing is probably going to happen, if not worse, when you do it again, because we have nukes now. And also how the appeal of military adventurism and loosely based, at any rate, leftist rhetoric or solidarity with leftist groups is still an effective tool for this kind of stuff. And to that end, at least for a few minutes, I'd like to talk about the Boogaloos. Boogaloos and references to a Boogaloo, Civil War II Electric Boogaloo, I hate the fucking internet, started appearing online around 2009 or 2010. And it started as part of online white supremacist insurgency groups. And often, the Boogaloo itself was framed as a race war. The Boogaloo fairly started as interchangeable code for DOTR, Day of the Rope, a reference from the Turner Diaries, if you recall the season 3 opening episode. By 2015, Boogaloo was most commonly observed on the most white nationalist, pro-violent spaces on the internet, and it was tracked to Iron March, for example, known for being the birthplace of Adam Waffen. By 2019, the term was being used by right-wing militias, gun rights organizations, and white supremacist groups. It was tracked in usage in relationship to a race war on Telegram, Facebook, and Twitter in 2019 and 2020, when popularity exploded following an armed standoff between a veteran and the police that was streamed on fucking Instagram. On November 23rd, 2019, a police officer approached the Mahopac, New York home of a 28-year-old Afghanistan war veteran to investigate an accusation of domestic violence. When the man refused to come out, police set up a cordon around his home. The man began streaming the events on his gun-themed Instagram account, where he used the username WhiskeyWarrior556. The man, who was wearing body armor and armed with a knife, believed the police had arrived to confiscate a 30-round magazine under his state's red flag laws. During the standoff, he began live streaming on Instagram referencing the Boogaloo and posting various memes. He gained over 100,000 followers during the incident, some of whom urged him not to surrender to police. One follower with a large following of his own encouraged others to travel to the town and shoot traitors. The man's own posts became increasingly threatening, but he surrendered to police after a 7-hour standoff. He was arrested on charges related to the domestic violence accusation at the end of the standoff. The county sheriff's office denied the man's claims that the arrest was related to weapons and reported that officers had found no firearms or magazines in the home. The event was later identified as the cause of a huge spike in Boogaloo-related comments on 4chan, as well as on other Boogaloo sites and right-wing militia social media pages, where followers had organized during the incident to disrupt police by bombarding them with phone calls and posting incitements to violence. On April 11th of 2020, Aaron Swenson, 38 years old, a self-proclaimed Boogaloo boy, was arrested after live streaming on Facebook his personal hunt to kill a police officer. On the live stream, Swenson said he was driving around looking for lone police officers to ambush, referring to finding his prey and hunting for tyrants in redcoats. Cute. After a high-speed nighttime police chase through about Bowie County, Texas, he was apprehended wearing a Hawaiian shirt and tactical vest with 3 firearms, 156 rounds of ammunition, and a sword. The guns were loaded. Swenson had shared Boogaloo memes on his Facebook page, and other adherents of the movement watched and commented during his live stream. He'd also posted a photo to Facebook the day after the shooting of Duncan Lemp, in which he wore a Hawaiian shirt and a combat vest, and used the hashtag, #HisNameWasDuncan. Swenson was convicted of attempted murder of a police officer, terroristic threats, evading arrest in a vehicle, and violation of the Texas Hate Crimes Act, and sentenced to 50 years in prison. And the COVID-19 lockdowns really served as a successful recruitment point for the Boogaloos as well. Opposition to the implementation of business closures and vaccine mandates saw huge spikes in Boogaloo online recruitment. Then-President Donald Trump described the group as, quote, lockdown liberators. The Tech Transparency Project found that 60% of Boogaloo-themed Facebook groups emerged following the lockdowns, and the movement amassed tens of thousands of followers. A report by Bellingcat identified Facebook as an important platform in growing the movement and allowing groups to organize and promote anti-lockdown events. Multiple armed clashes with police in 2020 further brought attention to the group, with a framing as being against government tyranny. For example, the Boogaloos piggybacked on the Second Amendment-themed 2020 VCDL Lobby Day event that was organized by the Virginia Citizens Defense League. That event was eventually declared a state of emergency by Virginia Governor Ralph Northam due to intelligence collected that, quote, armed militia groups posed a threat to storm the Capitol. We also began to see influxes of Boogaloo presence at Black Lives Matter events and protests following the death of George Floyd, and the group really attempted to establish a coalition with Black organizations over the shared cause of addressing police brutality, or so they wanted people to think. And evidence shows that Boogaloo members escalated protests into riots, antagonized confrontations with police, and ingratiated what was essentially a white supremacist insurgency group, whose stated ultimate goal was a race war, into a pro-Black activist movement. Evidence shows online that these groups used Black Lives Matter events as cover for their own ends and used Black bodies to fight the police with an ultimate goal of destabilization and the eradication of non-white people in armed conflict. As a for example, 3 men affiliated with the Boogaloo movement pled guilty to inciting a riot during the George Floyd protests in Minneapolis. Michael Robert Solomon confessed to organizing Boogaloo members online to create chaos in the hopes of starting a civil war that would be blamed on the Black Lives Matter movement. Benjamin Teeter of North Carolina and Ivan Hunter of Texas were among those who traveled to Minnesota to participate. Boogaloo activities have since turned to focusing on funding training facilities and establishing international connections for arms procuration. Hitler used the labor unions and pro-Bolshevists and war veterans. The fascists here use groups like the Boogaloos, the Proud Boys, and the Oath Keepers, and the Third Percenters, and ideologues like Alex Jones, who purport themselves to be neither left nor right, or above the left-right paradigm. And in a post-J. Edgar Hoover United States, we barely even have the level of pushback the Germans did. A desire to bolster our ranks with theirs in a misguided belief that we share a common goal can only ever end in more aforementioned bodies in more aforementioned ditches. And much like Adolf Hitler and the established members in the upper ranks of the Nazi Party, the white supremacists here may abide people like Candace Owens and Ye West and Milo Yiannopoulos, etc., because of their usefulness to the overall cause of advancing a fascist state in the United States of America. But those people will end up the same way as the rest of us when they are no longer useful. And I think that that is an important and often overlooked lesson on the left in the modern day. Hell, it's an oft-overlooked lesson on the right, too, evidenced by the sheer number of non-Aryans who keep talking about how awesome Adolf Hitler was. I mean, look, you're useful because you're rich or attractive or popular, but if you honestly think that you have a place in the world you're trying to help build, you're out of your goddamn mind. Because, as we see, this cottage industry that I keep making reference to of self-hating marginalized people on the far right fail to recognize that there is precedent for self-hating marginalized groups in right-wing extremist groups, and what ultimately ends up happening to them is, well, you've heard me mention it several times at this point. So everyone should remember, when you're talking about a group that wants to establish a state based around the purity of the white race run by the firm hand of patriarchy, and that ain't you. You're only gonna be useful as long as you're useful, and there's only so many things that happen to you. I mean, we opened this season talking about the Turner Diaries and how their racist Bible essentially outlines as much, that even within the great white race, those who are not useful can be sold into slavery, given as sex toys to Jewish people for punishment, forced into starvation for not doing what they're supposed to do as far as the regime is concerned. The idea of the white ethnostate doesn't necessarily mean all white people. It's a very, very specific group of extraordinarily ruthless white people who hate other white people almost as much as they hate the Jews and black people and the Chinese and gay people and communists, and you get the general idea. We'll throw Catholics in there for good measure. But that this sort of exclusionary socio-political ideology doesn't stop at one group. And the Nazis are a great example of that, too, that it wasn't just a single group targeted for extermination, exclusion, isolation, or victimization. It was every group that wasn't this very, very specific and ever evolving and shrinking class of people. The Nazis put Jews in camps, homosexuals in camps, the Roma, people who practiced esotericism and spiritualists, the late trade unionists, pro-Bolshevists, socialists, magicians, fucking twins, for Christ's sake. Like, there was a never-ending list of enemies to fund a forever war to mobilize the people in the furtherance of the state, which at the end of the day was one guy. And he got there by convincing everybody he gave a fuck about them. So, you know, with like an election coming up and all of these various cults of personality floating around, and the general idea that in order to stop a fascist creep, we should embrace the lesser of two evils, for example. And I think that history illustrates that the lesser of two evils is still, in fact, evil, and also sort of a soft opening for fascism whenever people become generally disenfranchised at the lack of progress over a continued embrace of the lesser of two evils. Perhaps history bears that out. And also perhaps a desire for militant authoritarian overthrow without any sort of a plan besides using the general populace as a meat shield between yourself and the government also does nothing but engender resentment between your political movement and the government. I mean, and the general population, maybe also that. And whenever the general public feels like the only thing that leftist groups are good for is using the people to get things that they want politically, and the right is presenting itself as, we basically want the same thing they want, but we're not going to throw you into a meat grinder, guess what fucking happens? And it's something that I think is important because we're doing it here. So there you go. And with that, that is all I've got for today's episode of the show. I hope that this was illustrative. I've been, like I said at the top, I've been meaning to do this for like 2 years now or something like that. So I'm glad to finally get this one in the can. But that's about the long and the short of it. Don't make deals with people who are probably Nazis because you think you both have a common cause in hating the United States government. There are lots of extraordinarily shitty people who also hate the United States government. As it turns out, that's a really, really, really low bar. You know, marinate on that, I guess. But we'll be back. Same Mox time, same Mox channel. On the next episode of Come and See, we're going to discuss the post-World War II pipeline from Germany to South America. We're going to talk about Odessa, and we're going to talk about Evita and how you shouldn't cry for her because she had lots and lots of Nazi gold. So it'll be sort of maintaining the theme of Nazi things, but getting a little bit back into the conspiratorial side of the show to steer us towards the finish line on this Friday before we return to the sunken city and slumber until Black History Month when we reawaken to terrorize the airwaves and all of the squares. But until then, concentrate on the HEP, everybody. I have been Moxie O'Brien, this has been Come and See, and I will catch all of you beautiful people on the flip side. Smooches, deuces, dig it.
Finished.